Current State on WKAR. Welcome aboard. We are glad you're here. I'm Mark Bayshore. Among other segments coming up in today's program, we'll explain a recent concern over a proposed nuclear waste site on the shores of Lake Huron. This is in Kincardine, Ontario. You may have heard about this. We've dealt with this at least once before here on Current State. Apparently, some important numbers involving radioactivity got fumbled recently, and someone pointed it out, and the debate continues over burying low and medium level radioactive waste about a kilometer from Lake Huron. We'll learn more from the Michigan Environmental Council's James Clift. And I want to thank all of our Current State team for taking up some slack while I was out recovering from a virus. Many thanks to one and all, Joe Lindstroth and Emmanuel Berry in particular. You are the best. At the top of the program, East Lansing officials are working on the city's budget for the coming fiscal year. The $32.7 million spending plan features a small millage rate cut for 2015. There will be meetings and public forums on the budget over the next few weeks, and the City Council is scheduled to vote on the plan on May 20th. Joining us today to go over the numbers is East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas. Welcome back to Current State, George.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. From your perspective, how have budget and spending priorities shifted in East Lansing in the past 12 months?
Well, I think that over the past 12 months, we've sort of made a shift in focus, and we're wanting to move, instead of prioritizing OPEB, which is our other employee, post-employee benefits, which is really funding retiree health care and legacy costs, we're switching a little bit more of a focus to infrastructure. And the reason we're doing that is because for the past 5 years, we made a big effort to fund unfunded portions of our legacy costs. And that actually behaved as a second reserve for us. So during tough times, we could have utilized some of that money in reserves. But now that we see a slight shift in the economy and things improving, we are more comfortable shifting back to focusing more on infrastructure, streets, sidewalks, and the like.
Yeah, you've enjoyed bumps in revenue from both property taxes, and you expect some amount more from the state in revenue sharing. Yet overall, the budget you've proposed is just a hair less than last year. How did this play out exactly?
Well, it's certainly good news for us that our two largest revenue sources for the first time in years are both going up. They are very small increments up, but certainly up is the right direction for us. So that gives us a good sense of optimism that we're on the right track. Overall, the budget varies year to year depending on how much spending, how much reserves you use. So the fact that it's down a little bit from last year, you have to dig deeper and find out what exactly is the cause of that. But overall, good news for us because both of those larger revenue sources for us are going up a small amount.
And you mentioned greater investments in infrastructure and roads. How much more spending are you proposing, and what will that be spent on if this plan is approved?
Sure. What we're looking at now over this year and next year is $900,000 additional from the general fund into streets. So we have separate pots of money for major and local streets. We get money from the state to do those projects on an annual basis. But we are looking to supplement that with additional money from the general fund, and that's the $900,000 figure.
And in a typical year, that wouldn't be there at all?
No, it would not be there. Okay. In past years, we haven't had the ability to supplement from the general fund because we've simply been providing the needed services. We've also been making that OPEB payment, like I mentioned, the retiree health care payment.
Right.
So it's a shift in priorities, and with the additional money we have, instead of focusing on legacy costs, we're focusing on infrastructure.
So almost $1 million more on streets. How will you determine which streets? How does that play out?
Well, there's two separate pots of money. There's major and local streets. Major streets are obviously designated as the larger streets that we have. Local streets are your neighborhood streets, the smaller streets in subdivisions. So you can't commingle those pots of money. So the state gives us money to do major street projects, and that's based on their condition, essentially. Local streets...
Is it clear which major streets you're going to work on if this passes?
Yes. Yeah, we have a number of sections, a section on Harrison, a section on Coolidge, a section on, I think there's, Harrison Road actually is going to be the section that goes between the University Kellogg Center, which is quite a roughed up section. So there's a number of sections that people will see it's pretty significant or direct improvement in some bad areas of roads. And then with local streets, we're going to be working on the Walnut Heights neighborhood, which is in need of some resurfacing of all the roads. So basically all the roads in that neighborhood will look like new roads.
We're talking with East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas about his proposed 2015 fiscal year city budget. Has the hard winter forced a change? I mean, if the winter hadn't been so hard, do you think you'd be investing $900,000 on streets?
It's been our plan all along to focus on streets. Cities have what's called a PASER rating. It's a pavement and asphalt surface assessment. It's a standardized way of assessing your road condition. Our condition of our roads has ticked downward over the past dozen years. So we really knew we had to do reinvestment in our roads. We've been planning it for some time. It's just been a matter of doing it at the right time. We've been able to, like I said, make good progress on our legacy costs. So we believe it's time to focus, and certainly the council has been encouraging us to focus on streets and sidewalks.
Your property tax base is forecast to rise 1.6%. How confident are you that that trend will continue?
Well, it's actually quite a lag in that. So we already see signs. It goes back about 6 months to a year. So you actually are looking, sales now for this year will impact next year's tax. So you're pretty confident that the trend is continuing and actually perhaps even speeding up. So current sales will impact us next year and benefit us next year. So you sort of get some time to know that things are going the right direction.
Before we get a little bit more into expenditures, George, talk to us about the response to the budget, first from the City Council and then from the public at large. What have they had to say?
Well, this process starts with the Council about 2 months ago. In February, we have a financial retreat, and we talk to our Council and say sort of the general direction we want to go for the next 5 years. We lay out a five-year forecast, and then from that point, we get to hear their feedback of their support for that and if they have any other concerns. We also talk about a strategic priorities document, which looks at the big projects and initiatives they want us to do. And then we can sort of wrap that all into the budget to make sure we're able to accomplish everything they want us to accomplish. So from council, it's essentially their direction. So hopefully they've been pleased with the direction. And from the public, we haven't had that much feedback at this point.
Council member Ruth Beyer complained to the state news that the city gives away too much revenue in the form of tax incentives for new developments. I know Mayor Nathan Triplett took issue with that. Do you as well?
I think perhaps it was she had mentioned to me that it was a shorter portion of a whole quote. So I don't want to say, you know, to speak for her in that respect. But what I would say is that tax incentives for development are something that is pretty necessary and standard in cities if you want to encourage redevelopment. Redevelopment in your downtown is something that keeps it vibrant and refreshed. If you don't provide those kind of incentives, your downtown will simply deteriorate and it's not a place that people will want to go. So I think the incentives are well spent.
And that's what you say to citizens, to residents, taxpayers who maintain that there's too many sweetheart deals, there's too much incentivizing of development?
Well, certainly I think that it's necessary, and the argument is that the development wouldn't be there but for the fact that we gave the incentives. So without the incentives, there would be no growth, and that property tax value would not be there. But the other thing I'd mention is money that we've been shorted from the state over the past decade or more is certainly a great deal more than any incentives that we give away for development or forego for development. So I think that if we were to look at, I think the number we said for incentives for development is about $700,000 of tax revenue that we forego. The school gets about $750,000 more from those developments. So the East Lansing Public School benefits directly from that revenue. We forego about $700,000. You could easily find a number, $3 million or more, that between state shared revenue and fire protection money that the state does not give the city of East Lansing on an annual basis. So I would say that the state meeting its obligations to cities is a much bigger issue than any amount of incentives that we have foregone in the past.
ELPD is slated for a 3.5% increase to more than $10 million. I see the fire budget, though, almost exactly the same as 2014. Can you discuss police and fire spending for us?
Yeah, basically both operations are staying essentially the same. We have, somewhere in the range of 50 firefighters and about closer to 60 police officers. They're both very significant parts of our budget. Public safety is by far the biggest portion of our general fund, and rightly so. People count on police and fire and ambulance to have a strong response, and we think we certainly have that in East Lansing. The differences may well be something minor, like our police officers are purchasing new vehicles this year, and that would be in the budget. So that type of equipment may cause a variation in the budget, but there really is no large add in the police department. Essentially, the officer count and the firefighter count is staying flat from year to year.
We're talking with East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas about the 2015 fiscal year budget for the city. The city still faces, and you alluded to this earlier, a $90 to $100 million tab for unfunded city retiree health care and pensions. Is any money targeted to that?
Well, we have made great progress over the past 5 years. We've made our full retiree health care actuarially determined payment for the past 5 years. That's been about $1.6 million a year. So in a trust for that purpose, for retiree health care, we've gone from zero to $10.5 million over 5 years, which is great news for us, great news for the residents that we're meeting that obligation. So what I would say is we're making progress. It's going to be slow and steady progress. After we are able to devote some extra money to roads on an annual basis, we will look to see what we can do for retiree health care and legacy cost pensions with additional payments. We won't be funding it to that level on a year-to-year basis because roads have become our priority.
But this is something, it's just too big to take any other approach than just chipping away at it slowly? Is that your approach? That's your thinking?
Well, it's both. It's both us making additional payments and making our payments, and it's also a return in the economy because as there are good market returns, the pension plan that we are in through MERS benefits tremendously from good market returns. So they do a good job managing their funds. We were still for a time dealing with the loss of 2008, which had obviously for everybody very bad market returns. It hurt pension plans tremendously. So as that we have more years of good growth beyond 2008, it will start to raise the level of funding in our pension plan. It's already had a very good benefit on our retiree health care plan. And so I would expect that a combination of making incremental payments as we can and market returns will start to turn that around over time.
Our guest has been East Lansing City Manager George Lahanas. There's a public hearing on the East Lansing City budget tonight, 7 o'clock, Courtroom 2 of 54B District Court in East Lansing City Hall. The budget goes before the City Council for a vote on May 20th. George, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. Ongoing concern over a proposed nuclear waste site very near Lake Huron took a new twist recently. A Canadian government review panel is exploring the viability of a new underground storage facility in Kincardine, Ontario. That's about 111 miles across the water from Port Huron, Michigan. The facility, almost a half mile underground, but little more than a kilometer from the lake, would hold low to intermediate radioactive waste. Well, recent comments by a Canadian nuclear scientist suggest Ontario Power Generation, the utility behind the project, seriously underestimated levels of radioactivity at the proposed site. To help us understand what's going on, I spoke with James Clift. Mr. Clift is Policy Director for the Michigan Environmental Council based in Lansing. I first asked him to explain what the utility wants to build.
They're trying to locate a waste disposal site for their nuclear waste, the low and medium level nuclear waste that they've generated at Canadian nuclear generating facilities in the province.
And this is called a DGR, a deep geologic repository.
Yeah, their idea is, out of sight, out of mind. If we bury this stuff deep enough, maybe nobody will worry about it.
How deep is it?
About 2,000 feet below the surface.
Okay. And give us an idea of what low to medium level nuclear waste is exactly.
Yeah, so what they're looking at is how long do they expect it to stay radioactive. So the low level is clothing, things like that, where just a matter of hours or days, weeks, the half-life of the radioactivity starts to diminish, and it would be safe after a number of short number of years. The medium or intermediate waste Now, that can be radioactive for much longer. These are usually component parts to the reactor that were much closer to the fuel. They're not the fuel itself, but they were parts that maybe came close to it or in contact with it. And these can be radioactive for tens of thousands of years into the future.
And since it's proposed to be about a kilometer, that's just over a half mile from Lake Huron, there have already been environmental concerns raised. But more recently, we have Mr. Frank Greening, who's a Canadian nuclear scientist, who made some serious assertions. What did he say?
Well, basically, he said that the calculations they did were wrong. I mean, he worked for the Ontario Power Utilities for a long time. This was his area of expertise. And what he was criticizing, in many cases, they were basing how radioactive something would be based on theoretical models. And he said, we've got the measurements. We know how radioactive these are going to be. And he showed where they had miscalculated some things. And it was from 100 to 2,000 times more radioactive than they were initially putting in their report in their studies.
Well, several constituencies are key to this whole process, the utility and the government panel. Determining the viability of the site are just two of them. First, how did the utility respond to Mr. Greening's assertions?
You know, they said, okay, we'll look at this. They didn't, you know, blow him off immediately, but they went back, looked at some of their initial studies and said, okay, you're right. Our calculations were wrong. They could have been better, but we think this is going to be safe, you know, that it's still within the safety factors that we predicted.
And how were OPG's reassurances received?
You know, I think with a lot of skepticism. I think part of the problem is the fact that this is a utility owned by the provincial government. And now you've got other government officials kind of looking at its oversight. And the question is, you know, is it the oversight that we would expect to see in this situation when you got kind of the hen and the fox kind of both working together here? Mm.
And how did the government panel respond?
Well, we're still waiting for the final determination of the federal panel that's been looking at this. But the initial review basically said it was within the safety margins. They think this is still going to be a viable site.
We're talking with James Clift of the Michigan Environmental Council about the proposed nuclear waste repository proposed for Kincardine, Ontario, that's just over 100 miles away from Port Huron, the other side of Lake Huron. How else does OPG defend the suitability of this site exactly?
Basically, they say that this has been a site for a long period of time, that they have a lot of experience dealing with these waste materials. They've been dealing with some of the other low-level materials for decades. And basically, they say that given the nature of the geology, that the formations they're putting this into, we expect to be very stable, not in an area we've seen any earthquakes, so they don't expect to see problems long term.
But when they're confronted with somebody about the site's proximity to one of the Great Lakes, how do they respond?
Yeah, they talk about the fact that how deep it is, the fact that the lake is only 200 feet deep and this is 2,000 feet below the surface. So again, it's kind of like they're arguing that it is far enough away that they don't think it's going to cause a trouble.
Hmm. To what extent is this on Michigan's radar? Citizens, elected officials, anybody?
So we've seen the legislature did pass a resolution asking for a more thorough examination of this site. We've got a number of groups within the states that have been putting in comments in the public process that they've had ongoing and raising attention to this, calling for an evaluation of other sites. A lot of the argument has been that they had the site available, so they didn't look far and wide across Canada for a better site. So their alternatives evaluation, they think, has been substandard to this point.
And how do we remind our listeners how we deal with nuclear waste here in Michigan?
Yeah, so we're confronting some of the same problems. A, the high-level radioactive waste that's been generated in the United States is all still at the plant site where it was generated. So this includes the Fermi facility, Palisades, Cook, and even the one up in Charlevoix, long since closed. The waste is still there on site because we've never taken our high-level waste. And we looked at Yucca Mountain for a while, but we've never sited a high-level site. The low and medium level sites, we've had a couple of different repositories around the country. So a lot of ours has been shipped down to Savannah, Georgia, and some other facilities around the country. So we've had windows of opportunity where we've gotten rid of our low and medium nuclear waste, but we still have the high level waste on the shores of Lake Michigan, Lake Huron in the state of Michigan.
Now, this latest disclosure relating to the Ontario Deep Geologic Repository is more newsworthy after an incident at a New Mexico nuclear facility back in February, which has got the attention of these organizations in Canada. What happened in New Mexico and what makes it relevant?
Yeah, so this is a similar facility buried deep below the ground, has been handling a lot of the federal government's waste from their research facilities, from their weapons production repositories. They've been sending all their waste there. It's in Salt Mine. It's in a similar geological formation in New Mexico. So one of the vehicles that was taking salt out where they were kind of digging a place for more waste to go caught fire. There was a fire in the mine, and they've now documented the fact that there's been the release of radioactive material kind of both in the mine itself and at the surface, and that it may have been some exposure. So a number of employees were exposed to radioactive materials. They say that they don't expect major health problems from that, but there was exposure. They haven't been able to get back into the mine setting since that time because of the elevated radioactivity.
And this is being taken into consideration by the folks in Ontario?
It did catch their attention. They actually had a interim permits that they've now suspended out in New Mexico that where they were about to take more waste out there. I think the Canadian officials are saying, hey, we need a little better study of what happened there, making sure that the plans, the emergency plans on the books for Ontario are taking into consideration this type of accident.
So what's next in this OPG process?
So they continue to look at the site. So there's a federal panel that's looking at it and still kind of waiting for a final determination from them that this would be an acceptable site.
While you're here, I want to get your response to the latest IPCC report on climate change. This is just from over the weekend. It said that greenhouse gas emissions, primarily from the burning of oil, gas, and coal, grew faster from 2000 to 2010 than in any of the three previous decades. It proposes cuts in emissions of 40 to 70% by mid-century and almost entirely by century's end. Any response to that?
I mean, the quick response is when we're looking at energy, we really need to start looking long-term and at looking at all those potential costs and impacts of how we generate our electricity. In the case of fossil fuels, we have the carbon impacts that are significantly impacting our climate. We're seeing the storms. We're seeing kind of the impacts across the globe. In the nuclear case, of course, we're looking at that long-term storage issue. Both of these things say that we need to be a little bit more long-term thinking when it comes to energy. We need to start making the commitments in the energy efficiency area, renewables. We need to be serious about reducing our need for electricity and generating it in ways where we don't see these long-term impacts to society.
James Clift of the Michigan Environmental Council. Thanks, James.
Thank you very much.
The segment is supported in part by the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. For more news on the environment, visit GreatLakesEcho.org. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. It's Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and a number of events have been happening across the MSU campus and in the Lansing area to bring attention to the issues surrounding sexual violence. Today in particular, there are numerous events planned as part of Take Back the Night, and Current State's Joe Lindstroth is here with more. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. That's right. Today is jam-packed with events for Take Back the Night. There will be workshops, art displays, a candlelight vigil, and later tonight, the events will culminate with a march down Michigan Avenue from the campus to the Capitol steps. The events are, of course, meant to raise awareness about sexual violence, which is an ongoing, often silent problem in our culture, especially on college campuses. According to statistics, 1 in 4 women is likely to be raped or sexually assaulted while in college. And of course, we're seeing that problem manifest here in Michigan with both MSU and the University of Michigan under federal investigation for their handling of the issues. I recently spoke with two young leaders on the campus about sexual assault. Rachel Burzak is the coordinator of today's Take Back the Night events, and Laura Swanson is putting the finishing touches on a documentary film about sexual assault in the MSU and Lansing community. They both are also volunteers with the Sexual Assault Crisis Intervention Team, which means that when they're on call, they get paged when someone reports a sexual assault at the hospital. And I asked Laura to describe the state the victims are usually in when they arrive at the hospital, often just hours after the person has been assaulted.
Most of the time, the person's confused. I think that's absolutely the number one reaction that we get, because with sexual assault, it is confusing. So they're confused, they're anxious, and they're going to be weary of your presence. So it's important for us to be calm and to approach them in a nice fashion and just to tell them that we're there for them and for their support, and we don't expect anything out of them.
How often does your pager go off, Rachel?
My pager probably goes off, I would say, at least 1 to 2 times every time I'm on a backup shift, and that's usually 2 to 3 days, like usually a 72-hour period. A month I'm on backup, and within that 72-hour period, I will get at least one page, if not more than one.
And Laura, and you, when you're on backup, how often does your pager go off?
Well, I'm on backup right now, and my pager has gone off twice today, one for pediatrics and one for a sexual assault adult case. And I'm feeling like it's going to go off again tonight. So I agree with Rachel. When I seem to have the pager, it seems to be between 1 and 3 times.
This is relatively common. It'll go off at least once during your 72-hour shift.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
What does that tell you about sexual assault in our community that this pager is going off? Laura?
First thing it tells me that I'm glad that people are reporting and that they're aware of these services, because I don't think most people are. But then it also tells me that this is happening way more than people know about, because I really doubt that people within our community have any sense of, you know, people being sexually assaulted 2 to 3 times a day and going to the hospital for this.
Rachel, how often do victims, in your experience, press charges or file a formal complaint?
Very little. Sexual assault in general is one of the most underreported crimes in our country. We're talking 50% generously report, but I don't know off the top of my head how much people report to the police, but it's not as much as I wished it was. I know that.
And Laura, in your experience, how often do the victims report the incident to the police?
Most of the time when I've been on call, I can't say for after I see them in their state, but most of the time that I have been with them, they have been reluctant and not really interested in law enforcement, because I think there's just, you know, a sense of fear or being scared or being ashamed of this issue. And so I see the lack of reporting as being consistent with the statistics, even though I believe that the statistics still don't show as much lack of reporting as there actually is.
You often hear that it's not in the victim's best interest to file criminal charges.
Sure.
Why not?
Well, victims, if you're reporting sexual assault, unfortunately, in this country, we have a history of kind of putting the victim under the microscope when that happens, as opposed to the perpetrator. And so the victim is often worried or concerned about re-victimization, about having her private life splattered in front of a jury and her reputation smeared and belittled in order to try to excuse the assault that was committed against her. So I think just fear of having to be that raw and ripped wide open in front of strangers all over again after you've already survived, experienced the trauma in of itself, that's a whole nother trauma to have to deal with after that I think a lot of survivors just really don't want to deal with or have the strength for at that time.
And I think, Rachel, this brings up a larger point, and that's the idea of a rape culture.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Laura, what is rape culture? Can you give us a sense of what that means?
Rape culture to me is any sort of society or culture that excuses or normalizes sexual violence.
Can you give us an example?
Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, in terms of the objectification of women and men in magazines, you can see them displayed in ads in very sexual positions or as if they're under duress or if they are being raped. And that's kind of glorified or seen as sexy. Also promoting sex and violence in films, as well as, you know, we are in a society that's, you know, we have a lot of distribution of pornography. And with that pornography comes a lot of ideas and can be, you know, violence and sexuality can go hand in hand in pornography as well.
Rachel, how would you describe rape culture?
I mean, I think what Laura said is spot on. I think we can see it too in, I guess, kind of just the way that our society responds to accusations of rape. For example, if we're looking at professional athletes, a lot of the things that we'll hear in response to those rape allegations are, well, what did you expect, you know, going into his room that late at night? What did you think was going to happen? So a lot of victim blaming is what I imagine coming with rape culture, and really just by and large favoring the experience of the assailant over the experience of the victim, apologizing and defending rapists, apologizing for defending rapists rather than protecting the victim and empowering them.
Well, I think one of the reasons why sexual assaults are some of the most difficult crimes to prosecute is ultimately it comes down to a he said, she said,
yes,
or a she said, she said, or
yes,
whatever sort of combination of mm-hmm. genders you want to use in that situation.
Yeah.
What do the statistics show about women who lie about being sexually assaulted? Is that common?
No.
No, it's not. It's the same as any other felonious crime reporting. That's fake as well.
Which is around 2% false reporting.
So if we live in a rape culture where most sexual assaults are never charged and most victims don't report their crime, what do we do about the issue? How do you make it better? Rachel?
That's a really good question. I think that there are a lot of ways to make it better. I think on an individual level, just really kind of educating yourself, being willing to expose yourself to the reality of the situation, and being supportive. I mean, statistically, everybody probably has a friend or a family or somebody that they're close to that has experienced something like this to some degree. And maybe you don't know who that person is, but kind of being open and ready to support somebody like that, and help them feel comfortable coming forward. I think on a larger level, advocacy plays a huge role in really bridging those community gaps between service provision and survivors and the general population, to really just have that community education and prevention piece. So I think advocacy is huge in ending this.
Laura, to that point, how would you characterize your peers' knowledge of the issues surrounding sexual assault? I think especially among men, but in general among your peers, how aware are college-age students to the issues of sexual assault?
I think that it's getting better. But my problem is that I still often sometimes when I speak to people, they are just floored by the idea of 1 in 4 women or 1 in 6 men. And when I tell them about different forms of, you know, sexual assault and rape that do not follow, you know, the traditional rape schemas, they're also like very confused. And so that leads me to believe that we're not educating people enough and we're not telling them about how these things differ from how we traditionally have thought about rape and sexual assault within our society. And so I think that there's a grand lack of education within, you know, our MSU community as well as our, you know, outside that in the rest of our world.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Joe Lindstroth, and I'm speaking with Rachel Burzak. She's the coordinator of today's Take Back the Night events, and Laura Swanson, the creator of the documentary film Every 2 Minutes, which addresses issues surrounding sexual violence at MSU and in the Lansing area. Rachel, what role can men play in bringing about more awareness in sexual assault?
I think men can play a huge role. Especially when we're thinking about most men are not rapists. And I think that's something that's hard for people to hear or pay attention to when we're trying to have these conversations, is they automatically get on the defensive and, you know, we're crazy feminists who have this anti-male agenda. And that's not the case. Most men are not rapists. Most men are nonviolent in that form. So I guess as a man speaking out against rape, against sexual assault, if you're at a party and you see two drunken frat brothers, you know, tugging of war on a girl's arm who's clearly intoxicated to see who, you know, whose room is she going to go back to when this woman cannot consent to what's happening to her, as a man stepping in and saying, dude, that's not cool, that's really disgusting, and helping her get home safely as opposed to being the first one that can take advantage of her. To refrain from telling rape jokes, making light of the situation, and to speak out in defense of both women and men who experience this, because it's not something that only victimizes women. Yes, statistically, women are, by and large, the victims, but men are assaulted too, and men need that voice as allies and as survivors.
Laura, you have something you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think the primary thing is speaking out. Because I think that, you know, women have started to do this, and you still have a long way to go, but I think that it's, you know, it's good when we see the men come out and speak as well, because I think that there are a ton of male allies out there, but I don't think the general population sees it that way or knows that there are male allies out there, or that there are as many male survivors possibly as female survivors. And so I think speaking out and having that courage is what is going to change, you know, this society.
Absolutely. And speaking of perceptions and misconceptions, Rachel, you touched on it. What are the misconceptions of people who advocate for more sexual assault awareness?
Well, I think that one of the biggest misconceptions is that feminist equals man-hater. Feminist is nothing more than a label for advocating for social justice, and not social justice just for women, but that intersects with race, with sexual orientation, with ethnicity and culture. So I think that's the biggest misconception, is that we are angry feminists who have some kind of anti-male agenda, so we're creating this rape culture hysteria with inflated statistics to make people afraid. That's what I've been hearing a lot of recently, I guess, from people who oppose the work that we're doing. And so I think people are taking the focus off of what our actual goal is, which is to stop violence, to stop humans from treating each other this way, and to create safe spaces for people to talk about these experiences and to heal from them.
Laura, you're wrapping up a film entitled Every 2 Minutes. Tell me about it.
Okay, so Every 2 Minutes started because of RAINS, the national organization. They had a statistic come out that a certain number of Americans were sexually assaulted each year. And when you break that up, that counts to every 2 minutes passing a person within our nation is sexually assaulted. So based on that, and based on what I've seen working in advocacy, I wanted to do a film that showcased, you know, firsthand, the survivor's stories, what is happening within our community, and how that's not only happening here, but it's applicable to the rest of our nation. And so you get to see the advocacy programs, you get to see how people respond, how people are educated, and how we're working and fighting to end this violence within our community.
And you have testimonials from survivors.
Yes, we have 17 survivors in total.
Wow.
There are 17 survivor testimonials, and more to come, because on our website we'll be opening up a portal for people from around the world to be able to share their stories on our website as well.
Did you have a hard time finding people to share their stories with you?
Surprisingly, no. I did not. When I started mentioning this, of course, I run in circles with people that do this work and have become a lot more comfortable with it. But I've just been amazed at how many people came forward just from my posting, you know, anonymous ads or saying, hey, if you, you know, on Facebook, if you know of a survivor or a co-survivor that would be interested in sharing their story and coming forward, let me know. And we just kept getting so many people. And I think they were really excited that someone was there and wanted to promote from a good aspect, about sexual violence, and not promoting it through myths or doing anything like that, but really trying to get across the right message and shifting the blame where it needs to go.
And Rachel, later today, you have a busy day today.
Yes, I do.
Take back the night. You have events planned all day. What do you have planned?
All day. It's a marathon. So at 10 a.m., we'll be putting up the Clothesline Project and the Silent Silhouettes, which are the Clothesline Project are t-shirts that were created by survivors to give voice and image to their experiences. So they get a t-shirt and they can kind of write or depict whatever part of their story they want on there. And those shirts are hung from a clothesline through Beaumont Tower. From 11 to 3 p.m., we will have community workshops at the Lake Erie Room in the MSU Union. We'll be doing one called Healing Not Broken, a self-defense workshop, a sexual empowerment workshop, and one about rape culture and consent. And then we'll have a survivor speak out and candlelight vigil. 5 to 6:30 will be the speak out, and then 6:30 to 7 we'll have the vigil. And the vigil is really more like a safe space for people who maybe are still struggling with their experience, struggling to find a voice for it. And so that space is for female-identified individuals only. So at 6:30, the any male-identified individuals will break away to kind of the other side of Beaumont Field, where they'll host a men's forum and kind of talk about what you were asking me earlier. What is men's role in ending this violence? How can we help? What does that mean for us as survivors and as allies? And then we'll come back together at 7 p.m. to march down Michigan Avenue to the Capitol steps, where Tashmika Taroke from the Firecracker Foundation and Gretchen Whitmer will both be speaking. So hopefully we'll have a really good turnout. I think it should be really powerful. I'm very excited.
That's a long day of events planned.
It is very long.
Rachel Burzak is the coordinator of today's Take Back the Night events, and Laura Swanson is the creator of the documentary film Every 2 Minutes, which addresses issues surrounding sexual violence at MSU in the Lansing area. Rachel, Laura, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Joe Lindstroth.
And there will be a screening of Laura's film, Every 2 Minutes, at Studio C in Okemos. That's on Thursday, April 24th at 7 p.m. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Local moviegoers and science lovers will unite tomorrow for a screening of a new documentary film called Particle Fever. Particle Fever follows six scientists working on the launch of Europe's Large Hadron Collider, the largest experiment in the history of the planet. Here's a sample.
I've never heard of a moment in history where an entire field is hinging on a single event. The Large Hadron Collider, the biggest machine ever built, is finally going to turn on.
You take two things and you smash them together. You get a lot of stuff out of that collision and you try to understand that stuff.
Could be nothing other than just understanding everything.
The East Lansing Film Society will screen Particle Fever tomorrow night at the Studio C Theaters in Okemos. Here to talk about this fascinating look into the mysteries of the universe are MSU Physics and Astronomy Professor Joey Houston, along with Monica Dunford. Monica's a scientist at the Large Hadron Collider and one of the stars of Particle Fever. She joins us by phone from Heidelberg, Germany. Joey and Monica, welcome to Current State.
Thank you, Mark.
Hi, thanks.
I'm still dazzled by transatlantic phone calls, so I'm really excited about this movie. Let's start with a basic working description of the two things that people will learn all about in the movie. The Higgs boson, of course, but first, the Large Hadron Collider, or LHC. Here's another clip from Particle Fever, and it gives us a glimpse at the enormity of the LHC. Let's listen.
There are 10,000 people, over 100 nationalities.
Ciao, ciao.
100,000 computers deal with the data. In fact, the World Wide Web was invented at CERN so that physicists could share the data.
So, Monica Dunford, give us an understanding of what the LHC does that hopefully a layperson could understand.
Well, it's pretty simple. I mean, we basically take two things and we smash them together, and that's about it. It's just the complication of what we do is that those two things are extremely small, very tiny. It's the proton, so basically the building block of the atom. And we get it going at incredible speeds, almost to the speed of light. And we get them going around in a ring, a tremendous ring, and get them very, very fast and smash them together. And what we hope is that with that energy in that collision, there's very high energy in that collision, that we can produce new particles from that energy.
And one of the main missions of the LHC is to discover or recreate the Higgs boson. This is a term that's become more familiar to more people in recent years. But Joey, remind us what the Higgs boson is, please.
So one of the goals of the Large Hadron Collider is to try to answer some of the questions that we've had about the nature of the universe. And one of those questions is the origin of mass. How do particles acquire mass? There's a theory that was first developed 50 years ago, literally 50 years ago, that postulated the existence of a field that permeates all of space called the Higgs field, named after its originator, Peter Higgs, and that is responsible for giving mass to the different types of particles. If this theory is correct, then it should be possible to produce a manifestation of the Higgs field called the Higgs boson. This is something that we've been trying to do for decades, first at the Fermilab Tevatron, a lower energy collider outside of Chicago, and then more recently at the Large Hadron Collider. And this culminated in the announcement of the discovery of a Higgs-like boson in 2012.
Yeah.
Right. And so I was on a year ago to discuss that. And in the meantime, we've taken more data, we've done more analysis, and now we can fairly definitively say that this is the Higgs boson. And so it's one of the most momentous discoveries in high-energy physics.
Some more facts about the film. 500 hours of footage was shot over 5 or 6 years. It was boiled down to a 99-minute movie, and it follows 6 researchers, one of whom is Monica Dunford on the other end of our line. The editor, Walter Murch, worked on The English Patient, and in terms of storytelling, it captures a lot of the drama associated with the Large Hadron Collider and the search for the Higgs boson. Monica, what was it like watching your work, your colleagues' work, captured in this way, and then watching it as a film?
It was great. I mean, I think because, you know, there was so much intensity at the time of the startup. We had no idea if the machine would even work. It took 30 years to build. And, you know, so there was so much intensity, and all that time we were filming it, but it was actually really wonderful to, you know, years later come back and watch those times again without all the stress and with a full night's sleep and being able to kind of relive that experience again, because it was so exciting, and I'm so happy that, you know, this is to be saved for all time.
Was it ever intrusive having everything filmed like this?
Oh, yes. I mean, it definitely, you know, the minute you put a camera into a situation, people change. You know, they get more stiff. They don't like to be, they're cautious about what they say. But, you know, there were a lot of cameras in the control room at that time. And so I think people started to get quite comfortable with the cameras. And so it is very real. The film does really capture how people are.
The scene that I really liked was the one where you were walking around with your laptop and telling everybody, look at these plots, look at these plots.
Well, I mean, I think that was one of these moments where there was just utter euphoria after the beam came on. I mean, it's 30 years, and we always were just afraid that something disastrous would happen. To some extent, we did have a big accident and had lost a year of time, but you know, the fact that it's working, the fact that we discovered the Higgs boson, I still can't believe it. It's amazing.
Monica, tell us a little more about your particular role at the Large Hadron Collider.
So at the time of the startup, I was in control of one of the subsystems. Basically, it was my responsibility to make it work, which was quite stressful. So I spent a lot of hours in the control room, and so I think my role in the film is really to show the experimental side, to show what it means to be in the control room, boots on the ground, getting the machine to work. There's other characters in the film which are, you know, more theoretical, trying to talk more about the math behind it all. But I spend a lot of time cabling and, getting dirty and,
Joey, why would you say a non-scientist should see this film?
I think because it humanizes this, what might seem a very abstract, very esoteric quest, right, to try to, again, probe the secrets of the universe and show that this is done by people, right? This is done by people that I think that the non-scientist audience can relate to. It shows some of the excitement that we have, some of the enthusiasm that we have, and hopefully allows the non-scientist to appreciate a bit more about the results that are coming not only out of the Large Hadron Collider, but coming out of science in general.
Once again, we're talking about the movie Particle Fever. The documentary will air Wednesday evening, 7:30 p.m. at Studio C Theaters in Okemos. Monica Dunford, when you meet people in the world of physics and you tell them you work at the Large Hadron Collider, what's their response?
Their response is oftentimes like, wow, it's awesome. I've heard about that on the news, which is an incredibly refreshing response generally for physicists, because normally when physicists, you know, talk about their work, people think like, oh, God, I hated high school physics. So when people, you know, there has been a lot of press about it and people are really excited about it and they're excited about the results. And so for me, that's great.
And aside from this film, Joey, I know the two of you are working on a project together. What can you tell us about it?
we're very glad that we finished the first draft of the paper. That's the primary thing. It's actually looking at a physics topic related to Higgs boson production. And I should say that studying the Higgs boson is a very important topic for the Large Hadron Collider. But it's just one of many, many, you know, hundreds of physics topics. So Monica and I have been looking at the production of another type of a boson called a W boson, accompanied by what are called jets of particles, you know, high-energy sprays of particles that will enable us to understand more about what we call the Standard Model, as well as to understand similar types of events that involve Higgs bosons.
Our guests have been MSU Physics and Astronomy Professor Joey Houston, along with Monica Dunford on the line from Germany. She works at the Large Hadron Collider, and she is featured in the documentary Particle Fever. You can see it Wednesday night at 7:30 p.m. in the Studio C Theaters in Okemos. Good luck. Thanks to both of you.
And there are only 40 tickets left, I checked before coming on. So.
Very good. Okay. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with Virginia Poet Laureate Sophia Starnes. Also, our Neighbors in Action segment features CASA for Kids, which advocates for abused and neglected children in Barry and Eaton counties. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us for Current State on WKAR.